This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much indeed, Teresa. Now, we've got our second discussion session. You have to go, Cara? Or you're going to stay for a few minutes. Good. I'm glad about that. We've got just over 20 minutes, so a healthy amount of time. The same ground rules as earlier on. Can you wait for one of the two roving mics to reach you before you you start speaking? I wonder if I can exploit my position as chair to ask Theresa May, first of all, because it's one of the two issues that I think have come up time and time again at this conference so far, this question of gender neutrality and the way that the statutory obligation on gender equality is being interpreted. Now, if I've got you right, you said public bodies must not be forced to be gender neutral. So what would an incoming Conservative government do about that?
Well, I think the key issue, as it has been raised with me, particularly in relation to local authorities, is about a misinterpretation of what their duty is. And I think the key thing that we would do is actually be providing very clear guidance to local authorities about exactly what this duty means and where they, you know, where they can and cannot be using that in the way that they are doing at the moment, to say, well, we've got to provide services for everybody equally and it doesn't matter if it's women only. So it would be absolutely clear guidance. This public equality duty does not mean that where the victims of something like domestic violence are disproportionately women, you cannot provide services particularly for women. And that's, right.
So you're not in any way suggesting repealing the legislation?
We're not talking about repealing the legislation, right. No. We're talking about the guidance to local authorities, because there are other benefits of the legislation.
Sure.
It's just about how it has been interpreted at a local level.
All right. Well, I hope that's clarified that. Well, Jane, you have spoken, so can I get somebody, lady here, and then gentleman there from Doncaster, I think, if I'm right.
Hello, Lindsay Hall. I'm Deputy Cabinet Member of Community Protection at Westminster and just recently appointed lead on violence against women. Two questions for Teresa. We heard earlier about the disparity in services between Scotland and the rest of the country. It strikes me that it cannot be disassociated with the vastly higher level of spending per capita in Scotland under the Barnett formula, and I'd be interested to know, since that impacts on services here in England and particularly on our services we're interested in discussing today, what an incoming government will do to redress that imbalance. And the second question is... is it not time for forced marriage to be made a criminal offence against which the criminal justice system can have a much clearer direction and by which we can actually impart a much stronger message to those communities who still cling on to those traditions when they come here?
Just before you respond to that, has anybody else got any thoughts on either of those two points? Not immediately. Well, Janet, yeah, if you can be fairly brief. You don't need to address both of them, but...
I will be brief. Janet Beach from the End Violence Against Women campaign. We're keen to see a centralised and centrally coordinated strategy on violence against women. My question is related to the Barnett formula issue. We know that the Conservatives are very keen to see decentralisation of power down to local authorities. We're worried that that will result in a reinforcement of the postcode lottery that we're trying to get away from. I just wondered how you anticipate dealing with that, especially from a funding point of view.
All right. Well, if you can maybe pull both of those funding questions together and then the forced marriage issue.
Yes. I mean, in response to the first issue, there are no plans to... look at to change the Barnett formula. I think the issue I would identify between Scotland and England is actually largely about a willingness to identify this as an issue on which there should be a clear focus and for which there should be a clear strategy. There is going to be an issue, of course, with the localism agenda that we've adopted very much as a party. But it's about getting the sort of balance right between the role of central government and the role of local authorities. And the way I look at it, I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all model that is appropriate for central government to say should be adopted in every part of the country, because there will be different circumstances, rural areas versus urban areas, different issues that people have to deal with. So I think it's right that local authorities would have an ability to be able to identify what is going to suit in their particular area. One of the things that we would want to do, though, is to be identifying more clearly good practice where it occurs and actually trying to promulgate that to local authorities. And, you know, in the End Violence Against Women strategy that we published, I identified, for example, what I'd seen in Croydon with the Family Justice Centre down there. Also what I'd seen, but in Oxfordshire, I'd seen a different approach being taken with domestic violence champions in the different partner agencies, which was working very well in the Cherwell district. So I think there are different solutions, but what is key is identifying these, but then encouraging others to look at these good models and be taking that practice on where it suits in their particular area.
Can I, just before you move on, if you're going to move on to forced marriage, can I just press you a little bit more on this question of funding? Because, again, one of the preeminent themes of this conference so far has been the problem with moving from needs-based grants to a commissioning system, a competitive tendering system. It's making it much harder for small specialist providers to continue providing services. What would your government's view be on that?
Well, I think if I can come at it from the angle of what I am hearing at local level, people may say something different here and be interesting or reinforce this. What I'm hearing at local level is that one of the problems with this commissioning approach that is taking place is that what is happening is people are commissioning more generic services and not being willing to commission the specific services.
Yeah, that's very much the point that's being made.
And I think that's, in a sense, it seems to me that's part of what we were talking about earlier in terms of the gender equality duty and actually what local authorities recognise as being the sort of services that they should be providing and therefore the sort of services that they should be commissioning. And from my point of view, in terms of looking at commissioning, I think that they need to be looking perhaps rather more at outcomes. Is this a body that we know is actually going to be able to produce the outcomes we need, which is the support for the people who are concerned in relation to this? And I suspect in the process that it's going through at the moment, there isn't that element being looked at.
I wonder how it fits with your localist agenda to be sort of waving a big stick and saying to local authorities, look, you've got this wrong. You need to be looking at this in a different kind of way.
Well, as I was saying earlier in response to Janet, there's a balance there between the central government role of identifying good practice and identifying what the services are that are needed, but local authorities being able to provide them in the way that they think fit. It is not an easy, I fully accept, it's not an easy balance to get. And it's something that we will have to work at. But certainly it's only relatively recently been raised with me, this issue of the way commissioning is now being approached in relation to the services that are being provided. And part of it may be about the sort of, because government does have discussions with people like the Local Government Association. We've talked to them about some of the issues around the impact of splitting children and adult services, for example, at local authority level on domestic violence and whether that's helping to identify properly exactly what's happening within families and within households. So there's not an easy silver bullet that's going to say immediately everything's suddenly going to be right on this.
Okay, so your thinking is still a work in progress. Just briefly
on the forced marriage.
Forced marriage, yeah.
I think this is a very difficult issue. There are those who are involved in working with victims of forced marriage who say that it should be a criminal offence, but I've also met groups of women dealing with people who are involved in forced marriage who say it should not be a criminal offence. And there's a very difficult balance judgment. Obviously, making it a criminal offence would send a very clear message. But the issue is, would it mean that actually fewer cases of forced marriage were identified and therefore fewer women and girls were being helped? Because that issue of the stigma of the criminal offence would mean that actually people wouldn't come forward and you wouldn't be able to identify. At the moment, my view is still on keeping it as it is and let's see how things are going and look at some of the issues like helping to train teachers in looking at identifying those girls who might become the victims of forced marriage and start to see the sort of signs that could be that somebody's about to be taken away and appropriate action being taken. I think if we can do more perhaps on that preventative side of it and see if that how that operates. So I don't dismiss the possibility of making it a criminal offence at some stage. I just, at the moment, I think the balance of the argument is still in favour of not making it a criminal offence.
All right, thank you for that. Did you want to say something very briefly?
Yes, yeah. If I could just contribute to the commissioning discussion as well. You know, I think it's absolutely right that that part of it is about the misinterpretation of the gender equality duty, and certainly we found evidence of that in the Map of Gaps project. But I think it's also about the process, the process of shopping for services means that women's organisations can't compete with larger providers who say that they're going to deliver all of the support and all of the same things, but do it cheaper per unit. Because those services aren't actually rooted in the principles of women's services around agency and empowerment, but that's a very difficult outcome for a women's service to try and put across to a commissioner who actually is going to look at the bottom line. And I think that, you know, it's part of the guidance for commissioners needs to be that it is women's services that deliver on obligations, international human rights obligations to address the long-term harms. And so I think it's also about changing the process for them too.
Okay, well, we'll leave that point there. There was a gentleman there from Doncaster, and then, there and there.
Thank you. I speak with a voice prosthesis, so you'll have to kind of accommodate me, I believe. My name is Dennis Akin. I'm the domestic abuse coordinator for Doncaster PCT. Two things, really, and one is around what Theresa May touched on, was the training for police officers. What is emerging in recent years has been specialist units who are dealing with the top tier of intervention, i.e. the high-risk cases. Very often the other lower-tier incidents are dealt with inexperienced officers who have no way of it all on how to deal with domestic abuse. Consequently, those incidents then go on in succession to become the high critical incidents that have to be dealt with by MARAC. So I think there is a fundamental need to readdress that issue, and I would like more comment on that if it is available. Secondly, we've had a lot of talk about the mapping of services, and I believe that this is concentrated on the response from local authorities. In actual fact, development of services is very often carried out by the multi-agency forums where voluntary sectors are actually taking the lead. I particularly highlight that in Doncaster, where the lead for both the honour-based violence strategy and the rape and sexual abuse strategy is being led by the voluntary sector. So I think we need some more work on the actual mapping process.
All right, thank you very much. Are either of the other next two questioners on those, either of those points or not? Okay, very very briefly then on police training. We'll deal with the police.
Theresa Amadeep Sermal, IPCC. I raised with you when we met last year about the fact that there is no mandate or requirement for police officers still to be trained in domestic violence. And I wondered what, if anything, would a Conservative government do to reverse that?
Good, that's short and sweet. Okay, well, if you'd like to tackle the issue of training of police.
Yes, and we see this as being very important. To pick up the comment that Dennis made, certainly what was brought home very much to me talking to some victims of domestic violence was that if they were dealing with the specialist police officer from the domestic violence unit, they understood, they knew the issues. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, where the perpetrator was beating the door down, actually, you called out the police officer who was on duty, who probably had no training in domestic violence and didn't actually understand and didn't appreciate what the circumstances were. And there have, of course, been cases in other forms of violence against women, and I have had a particular case relevant to my constituency of stalking, where the pattern of behaviour was just not identified as being sufficiently serious. And the woman was murdered by her stalker, despite the fact that he cut the brake pipes on her car, and this had been reported to the police, and the file was moved from in-tray to in-tray for 2 weeks, at the end of which she was dead. So there is a real need. Now, the question about whether it should be sort of mandatory part of the training, I mean, we're looking at how the training should best be done. Because in a sense, there are two issues around training for police officers. There's training for anybody who knew coming into the police force, and there's training for the officers who are out there already. And so I'm talking to my colleagues in the who obviously deal with police matters about how that training can best be ensured, and how it can best be provided. Because it's not easy, because there's a variety of issues that we need to deal with here. We've got to make sure that we're doing it in the best possible way, so that the training is actually going to reap benefits in terms of what the police officers' approaches and attitudes are going to be. But it is something we very much see as something that does need to be addressed.
While you're on this police point, I mean, do you take any view on the ACPO suggestion this week about a national register? Do you see that as being workable, or a national register of abusers?
I think they came up with some interesting ideas. I mean, I think I'm not going to give an absolute yes or no on it. I need to look and think about it more more carefully, I think, and look into the details of it. But there was another aspect of what they proposed, which has temporarily gone out of my mind. Which
well,
I
was
thought
the
was
creating a course of conduct.
The course of conduct.
Which
I thought
is very
that was is controversial, but I think this is an interesting. But it is. This is a sort of one particular bit of the problem, if you like, very much focusing on the person who has that course of action and can therefore be identified. And I'm tempted to say that in relation to the register, of course, all too often what we see is, it's all very well having registers, but it's getting people properly on there and information being properly shared.
Yes. Well, I was going to say the Conservatives are generally sceptical about databases, so I
indeed,
wouldn't have thought you'd be too sympathetic to that. Your second point was, you'll have to forgive me, but I can't remember now what your second question was.
It was about the mapping process.
About the mapping,
and,
that's right, yes.
That should take account of voluntary sector as well as local authorities.
Yes.
I think that's probably not so much one for me as for
I think that one might be mine, Okay, thank you. We're always really interested to hear new ideas about how the mapping process can be developed. It's, you know, it's a methodology in its infancy. We don't map multi-agency forums because they don't constitute a direct support service in themselves. What a multi-agency forum will do is refer women to direct support services. That might not be the case in Doncaster. It's certainly the case almost everywhere else. And it's the local authorities that are the public body under the gender equality duty, not the multi-agency forums. But I am really, really glad to hear that in Doncaster it is the voluntary sector taking the lead through the multi-agency forum, because from my experience of attending multi-agency forums across different nations and regions, the voluntary sector is very often being pushed out of that process, voices marginalised, and it's being moved into the statutory sector. So I suspect, and I can see that's having resonance around the room, so I think there are real lessons to be learned from Doncaster, which was my birthplace, so I'm fascinated. Thank you.
Well, it's good news for Doncaster, because it hasn't had the best of publicity in recent years, especially to do with child protection. But now, there's a lady there next to Sandra, and then gentlemen there waving frantically. Yep.
I suppose I was thinking earlier about what you said about rhetoric, and I'm aware that there's lots of strategies, and strategies for violence against women, strategies for domestic violence. I manage a counselling agency and also do training predominantly around domestic violence, and the feedback I get from people sort of keys into the postcode lottery, in that what it says is a lot of local government do box-ticking exercises to meet their strategy implementation. And I wondered what Theresa May has to say about thinking about governing that process. How do we ensure that a blue chip service is available for women who are victims of violence? And it's not just a box-ticking exercise in an overstretched local authority.
Is your point in any way related to that? No, it isn't. Okay. Well, if you could deal with that very briefly.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And it's a temptation of politicians to spend all our time talking about strategies and consulting, and you end up nothing actually happening on the ground as a result of that. And it's absolutely crucial that it does happen on the ground, as things do happen on the ground. And you're also absolutely right that, of course, and in a sense, the more government sets targets for local authorities and requirements on local authorities, the greater the temptation to do things that do appear to tick those boxes, as opposed to actually being about the service that is being delivered. Which is why, I mean, one of the issues I raised earlier in looking at the commissioning is about how we might be able to look at more at outcomes. So what is actually happening, rather than have you got a policy on this, or, you know, have you held so many meetings, or have you done this, that and the other? Have you got a strategy document? So I think we very much want to focus the efforts, and this is a general issue actually across public service, on the outcomes. So are we actually achieving what we're trying to achieve and what we want to achieve, rather than just having that layer that's able to say, well, yes, we've done this, we've done this, we've done this, therefore everything's all right, isn't it? So very much take
sorry,
the point.
Before I move, is yours a box ticking related question or not? No, it's not. Okay. Gentleman there then who's been waiting.
Thank you. I'm Tom Kyle. I run a specialist domestic violence project in Gateshead and Tyneside, which is actually a direct local authority provision. So in contrary to a lot of the previous sort of negative comments about local authorities, the one which I actually work for has made DV a priority, as well as our strategic partnership has done so as well. So I think this thing about postcode
a little closer.
Sorry, this thing about postcode lottery doesn't need to be like that. I'd just like to comment on your comments that you made about the present government's so-called coordinated community response, which in fact is through their criminal justice bit around Marac's, the specialist domestic violence courts and IDVAs. It's great, we've got them. But I think, again, it's about implementation. I think there's a tremendous tendency to think just because we've got it, it works. You mentioned difficulties around Marac's, but I'd like to highlight especially the bit around SDVCs, because still we're not actually, it's meant to give greater public confidence to victims, and there's little sign of that happening already in terms of retractions, etc. So women actually aren't getting more confidence that these courts will actually give them greater access to justice. You mentioned around breach of non-molestation orders. I think, again, there's a great deal of complacency to think that we have non-molestation orders, that they are always a greater safeguard. It is not always possible to get them because of, again, we heard earlier about lack of access to public funds. So that women who have higher socioeconomic status, who can't actually afford to get non-molestation orders, that is a real issue. And especially around, as you say, around breaches, it's actually surprisingly difficult to get a breach to be an order to be made. And the final point I'd like to make is around working with perpetrators. And this goes back partly to the financial pressures that were raised earlier. It's very easy to justify about work with victims for obvious reasons. It's much more difficult to justify around work with perpetrators, partly for sort of political reasons, but partly because in terms of volume, it's relatively low volume work. I think that's when finances are being squeezed, that's a particular difficulty that I have at the moment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, that's an interesting point because that's the first time that working with perpetrators has actually been mentioned this morning. Maybe you'd like to start with that. And
yes, well, there was a lot in that question, Tom. And can I just check, did I understand, hear you correctly, did you say you felt that the special domestic violence courts were not showing signs of giving women more confidence?
Yes.
Yes, right. Which is interesting because other people have said to me that actually they've seen them working well and helping to give that confidence. So it's interesting to get that different feedback. Working with perpetrators, I mean, this is, in a sense, it's part of the prevention strategy, is to try to make sure that people aren't carrying on with this behaviour. But I take the point about the funding issues, but also I think one of the issues which actually Sandra raised with me when I spoke to her a while back was about the appropriateness of some of the programmes that perpetrators are asked to go on, and whether they are actually effective, or whether, again, sometimes there's a bit of a box-ticking exercise, oh, well, it's OK because he's gone on a programme. regardless of whether that's actually going to have a good outcome or not. So I think you've raised an interesting area where I'm just going to be honest and say I don't have an immediate set of answers, but I think it's an issue that we do need to look at more closely in terms of making sure that any work that does take place particularly is actually going to be effective and isn't just part of that box-ticking exercise. On the issue of the specialist domestic violence courts and the changes in law and the non-molestation orders, these are areas where we want to look at how they're very much closely monitor how they're operating. I've had... It's interesting that this Ministry of Justice survey appears to be raising some issues around some questions about the impact of the criminalisation on the non-mol orders. I think that, because I've had mixed views from people who are actually involved on the ground, I've had solicitors and indeed there's some evidence from the judiciary that they feel that actually this has not been a positive step, but others who've said that they think that actually it has. So I think we very much need to look at the evidence, gather the evidence together and see what we need to do in that particular area. And just on relation to the postcode lottery and the comment I made about Marex, which you referred to, again, I get a very mixed picture. And some places I'm told that Marex are working extremely well, that all the partners are coming together and, you know, on as appropriate, and it is working. And in other areas that it's not. And I'd be very interested, because one of the comments that I frequently get is that often the partner that it's hard to bring together is health. Getting health engaged in this agenda can be... There are some good examples, but it can be very difficult to do that. So that's why I said I think we need to, again, look at how the Marex are progressing. It's a good idea, but let's make sure they're actually working well everywhere.
Well, that's a point that we might maybe to pick up this afternoon in one of our sessions. We're running out of time. The lady from Medway has been waiting very patiently, have you not? Or maybe you've forgotten what you were going to say.
No, just that there's been lots of emphasis on domestic violence, obviously because we're in a domestic violence conference, but nothing's been mentioned about domestic abuse, because in Medway we have the distinction between domestic violence and domestic abuse. And in your mapping you were doing, there was no mention about domestic abuse, so I was wondering where that is part of this whole conference. Sorry. Because at Medway we separate the two. We separate, you know, domestic violence and domestic abuse, because...
Well, do you want to deal with that very, very, very briefly?
The reason that we don't map domestic violence, domestic abuse services is because they are two terms generally used to represent the same thing, and within the umbrella term domestic violence, we would include psychological and emotional abuse that people normally reference when they mean domestic abuse. So we encompass everything within that one term.
The lady there, and then I know Jane has had her hand up, but you'll have to be very, very concise.
I'm Gwyn Raines, I'm from the NSPCC, I'm the Learning and Development Advisor for Domestic Abuse. I'm particularly interested in this aspect of definition about domestic violence or domestic abuse, because the definition itself often gets intertwined with things like family violence, and I think family violence and domestic abuse are two separate things, and we should be looking for about the power and control issue. The domestic abuse definition does not include children who might be in the 16 to 18 year old age bracket who are living with domestic abuse, and we've come across lots of young women who have young babies where they're coming up in terms of serious case review mechanisms. And it doesn't refer to children either, and I think that's a significant issue.
Can I leave that sort of park there, if you like, because it's going to open up an area that I don't think we can do justice to in the minutes or so remaining. The lady next to you, I think, had her hand up very briefly, while the mic is in that region.
Just very quickly, I was on the helpline a couple of weeks ago, and a woman that I was been dealing with, she's due to cultural reasons, she gave a negative statement, which meant, yes, the incident happened, which was like 2 hours of beating, and he'd threatened to cut her tongue off. But she gave a negative statement, which she said, yes, it happened, but she wasn't willing to go to court because of all the pressures around her. So a few weeks after, she'd got... he'd got a cheque for £500 from the constabulary to say it was a wrongful arrest, which gave him more power. And I'm just really frustrated with that, and I just thought maybe I could bring it here today, and if there was anybody that could give me any advice.
Well, again, I mean, that's a pretty extraordinary story, isn't it? Yes. And it's just there as a thought, actually, I suppose.
I suppose the point I was making there is, you know, if the evidence is quite clearly there, but the client doesn't actually want to make a positive statement, shouldn't that be enough for the CPS to carry it through anyway? And if it wasn't, fair enough, but for them to be sent a £500 cheque from the constabulary, just sort of...
I think it raises a whole range of issues, actually, about how the process takes place. I have to say, as a constituency member of Parliament who from time to time has tried to get the police to accept that they've made mistakes in certain cases, I find the alacrity with which they sent a £500 cheque absolutely amazing. Yeah. And the fact that they did that in that case. But obviously the point you're making, there's a more significant point in a sense, which is about the CPS and decisions being made as to whether to go ahead to charge and what evidence is needed in order to do that. And also about the pressures that can come on somebody to effectively force them not to take that case forward. And there's still an awful lot we need to do, despite all the new structures that have been put in place to try to help victims, to try, I think, sometimes to understand the particular pressures that may be brought to bear, particularly possibly in certain cultural circumstances, about, you know, to try to force victims not to take their cases forward.
We're in serious danger of missing our lunch. Jane, if you can make your point within a sentence or two.
Hello. Just to say, really welcome your concerns about prisoners and early release, which is clearly absurd, and that you'd want to put a stop to that. And
this is the end of custody. Yes.
The interesting ideas about New York police practice, because we find that if you want to affect change with perpetrators, it works wonderfully if they know they're under the gaze of the criminal justice system, as opposed to, you're trying to change them through counselling or something. So it changes the power balance. But it's great to hear new ideas like that. If you were in government, it would be good to be continuing discussions with civil servants about how can we find a way forward? You know, what new solutions might we be able to find? And just hope that you would want to continue that kind of dialogue and finding solutions.
And just to say, yes, I mean, basically, one of the things that I'm very keen on doing, and that we're doing across the board in terms of, I mean, my other portfolio as well and in other areas, is saying, is the good practice out there, away from the UK, that we can actually look at and say, hey, if we were to do that here, maybe it would be good, and look at, have those discussions about things. I mean, for example, on the stalking case, which I made a reference to earlier, it was quite interesting looking at what had happened in San Diego, where they've done quite a lot in terms of bringing different agencies together in relation to that issue. So I think it's very important that we do look widely to see what is working and talk to organisations like those represented here, who are the ones who are most likely actually to pick up where the good practices were happening and be able to bring that to the table.
OK, that's an appropriate point to end this session. Can I ask for a round of applause for all of our speakers in this session? And thank you.